Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
In full cry here.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name is Windy, and I'm joined by my psychic and best friend, Bardi. Hello, Bardi.
Hello, Windy.
And our tactics guy and Mourinho baiting friend, Nathan A. Clark. Hello, Nathan.
It's your boy. How's it going?
What happened last night on Twitter, Nathan?
Same as always. Okay. We're going to talk about Ndombele later, but I tweeted about Ndombele. My friend Mads tweeted something, I don't know, 2 years ago about Mourinho and Pogba and how Pogba was the superior asset, essentially. And I quote tweeted that tweet, copying it word for word. And it's got, I muted it, but I just checked it now, just as we're about to record. And it's got some positive interactions and some negative interaction. Mainly what I was doing is I wanted to draw the comparison between Mourinho's handling of Pogba and Mourinho's handling of Ndombele, rather than suggest things are as bad now at Spurs as they were at United with Mourinho. But I do also think it's quite possible they could get that way.
Sure, there was definitely some resonance there. I'm out of interest, had you remembered that tweet from Mads?
Yes, because I think of it fairly often.
Okay, fair enough. Before we get stuck into talking about the Man U game, I just need to do some shameless self-promotion. I'm starting, or have started, a new podcast with Flav, who hosts The Fighting Cock. If you are a Fighting Cock patron, you've already heard that podcast because a few of them have been released on that feed. It's called 15 Minutes with Flav and Windy. It's basically us talking about a subject of our choosing or of your choosing for 15 minutes, and when the timer goes, we stop talking about it. And so far we've done schools, we've done first girlfriends, we've done first jobs, we've done what is the point, those kind of things. It's been a lot of fun so far. We think people are going to enjoy it. If you enjoyed the episode that I did of this podcast with Flav and you enjoyed us interacting on that, then give it a listen. 15 Minutes with Flav and Windy. It'll be on all of your usual podcast platforms very soon. But we have a Spurs win to talk about. We finally won our first win in any competition since the 16th of February. That's absolute madness. Our first home win since the 2nd of February. Bardi, you write here that was Mourinho's longest run without a win in his managerial career.
Yeah, it just goes to show that he's a manager who's, even though we remember his days at Man United being pretty bad, they've never been this bad before. This is the darkest his managerial form has ever got. And I don't know if this would play on someone like Mourinho, whether it play on his mind or not, but it must have been affecting him. And I don't know if anything can affect his confidence, but it must have been playing on his mind a little bit. And it's great that we've finally got out of that rut.
Wait, is this being measured in games or days?
Games. This is measured in games.
I was going to say, like, far be it from me to defend Mourinho, but it's like, there's been no football. Okay, yeah. Was that six, seven games?
Seven games. This was our eighth game, yeah.
That's quite a lot.
It's a lot.
I did read some Gammon earlier tweeted that actually, since Mourinho took over at Spurs, only Liverpool and City have accumulated more points than we have. That is completely unverified. I cannot say for certain.
No, that's not true. That's not true at all. And I've seen stuff like that go around a lot. I saw it on the Spurs Reddit. There was something about when Kane and Son and Bergwijn were out injured, and it's just not true. There's a lot of, and the other day Mourinho was talking about like Drogba's record on him, and he read out the appearances columns for goals. Essentially said he scored a goal a game, which is like, Drogba's a really interesting case because he's regarded, and I think probably quite rightly, as an all-time striker, but his actual goals per game record is like abysmal amongst those level of players. But he was, you know, a big game
player. He had two hot seasons.
Yeah, essentially he had two hot seasons, and also, you know, showed up in finals and scored, you know, the one goal that won the game in the final sort of thing, rather than, so using Drogba. Anyway, the point is, just people, if you read a number, people will just completely accept it must be the absolute truth. It's not.
Yeah. I mean, I must admit, I looked at it and thought that cannot be right, because I was thinking of Wolves in particular. I was thinking of Wolves from Sheffield United, who I suspect will be ahead of us. Also, Chelsea surely have had a good run and they'll be ahead of us. So yeah, I did think straight away that can't be right, but it got a traction.
There was a point in the season when Mourinho first took over where we were flying in the form table, but then as injuries took their toll, that form obviously dropped away. So right now that's not true, but I think at one point we were one of the highest performers.
At one point, Tim Sherwood's win ratio was second to none.
True.
Yep. Oh, sorry, I just couldn't help but chuckle there. Mark Lynch on Twitter, he says, I've been a lot more impressed with the two performances than pre-lockdown. We've got attacking players back and they're starting to get fit. Dyer in particular looks so much better, or am I completely mad? Bardi, is Mark completely mad?
No, I don't think so. There's people looking for the positives in everything, but I think our performances against Manchester United, against West Ham, were vastly improved to the performance we were seeing before the lockdown. So that is definitely the case. I'm not saying the performances are perfect. I thought in spells against Man United, because I missed the Man United pod, I thought in spells against Man United we looked pretty good. And at moments against West Ham, a terrible West Ham, we looked okay. I'm more positive about us now than I was when I walked out the stadium after we lost to Norwich on penalties, for sure.
And Nathan, we spoke at length about the setup for the Man United game being the right setup for that game, but you were concerned about how we would approach other games. What did you make of the setup for West Ham?
Well, we grew into it. I think we struggled for the opening quarter, as it were, because we now have our half-time break and our water breaks at sort of 20-minute intervals as well. I'm assuming that there was some sort of tactical tweak, certainly by one of the sides, after the first water break, because after then, I don't know exactly what it was, but things really picked up. In the first 20 minutes, when we tried to move the ball in a slow and controlled manner, we couldn't get it through their midfield. And when we tried to move the ball in a fast and aggressive manner, we very quickly lost it. After that, we started to, again, I think, force it long, play fast and lose it, but then press quite well, having lost it, and managed to sort of pin West Ham back after that. We still struggled to break them down. I think an attacking midfield three of Son, Dele and Lucas is going to be somewhat creatively limited. But, you know, we etched away and etched away. We did a good job of restricting their counters and broke them down, eventually to the point where they had to come out and attack. And then, of course, we put them to the death.
Yeah, I think Nathan touched on something really interesting there. These water breaks, we saw in the first water break that Mourinho pretty much took it as an opportunity to do tactical shift. He got everybody in a huddle and things changed. Whereas in the water break in the second half, it was literally just a drinks break. So I think how football changes with these multiple breaks now, I think we might see this happen a little bit more, where plans can be better communicated and things changed. Because we definitely, I think after the first break and after the half-time break, our centre-backs definitely got a bit more ambitious and a little bit more confident on the ball. Whereas before, Noble playing this kind of weird defensive 10 was able to kind of cut out the passes into Lo Celso and Sissoko. But then as our defenders grew into the game and grew in confidence, we were able just to bypass Noble.
It's a bit sort of basketball timeout kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So Bardi said that he feels better than he did having walked out the Norwich game. I actually tweeted last night that I feel more down on Mourinho than I did before the break. I'm not sure if I still feel like that today. I think I was just a bit down last night.
You were down before the game, though, Chris, to be honest with you.
That's true. Yes. I was. I didn't like the team selection. So I think where it comes from is I'm not seeing what we're trying to achieve offensively. Hmm. The primary tactic, and this was certainly the case against West Ham, was we try and get the ball to Aurier as high up the pitch as possible, and he delivers a first or second time ball. And he was very erratic with his crossing. He wasted a lot of good opportunities to get balls into the box. And there wasn't a lot of variety to the play. What I would say, though, and many people pointed this out to me on Twitter, and they were right to do so, we are so much more defensively sound now. And that is the basis. It's the core of a Mourinho team, isn't it? That first and foremost, you set up as a defensively sound outfit that is able to defend narrow where it's appropriate and not concede shots in the area. And that is certainly the case. And Sanchez and Dier have been a big part of that. I mean, obviously, we know that Dier made the mistake for the penalty in the first game against United. But across the rest of the game, he was really, really positive. And in this game, perhaps even more so, he was very commanding, I thought. What did you make of Dier's performance, Nathan?
Yeah, so we talked about obviously he had a good performance and also gave up a penalty against United, but looked strong again. I thought looked like bold and brave in possession as well. You know, I often think of Eric Dier sort of receiving the ball under pressure, dallying for a second to wait for an option, allowing a player to be closed down, and then being too slow to turn with the ball and sort of losing things that way. But I think he's shifting the ball faster or more decisively, maybe. But yeah, strong in the air. I think he looks lighter, and I think that's been something that we've talked about before. He not that he's like been overweight, but he put on a fair amount of muscle mass. He was looking like a rugby player, and I think that was affecting his mobility. And he's looking a little trimmer after the lockdown, which many people are not. A more mobile version of Dier is a much improved player. I think defensively, if we looked, we did a good job of restricting United possessing the ball through midfield. We gave up a couple of chances towards the end, and obviously a penalty. So we gave up 1.7 expected goals to United, and we gave up 0.8 to West Ham. I wouldn't have guessed that much, but I guess there was sort of a couple of decent headers, weren't there, in the second half. But so that's two and a half across
four
two games.
Had a really good chance as well.
Yes. So I mean, it's felt defensively strong. It doesn't seem to be. It's not so much the case in the numbers. It'd be interesting to see how that goes going forward. I guess we haven't seen. Maybe except for the penalty, but then people say it's a contentious penalty. We haven't seen a major calamitous defensive issue in two games, which this season is a big deal, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, West Ham were incredibly passive, which was obviously a help. Bob N64 says, are we actually better defensively, or is there some other explanation for not conceding as many as normal? Buddy, what do you think? Is it continuity in the back line? Is it the midfield combinations we've used? Is it simply that individuals are playing well?
I think individuals are playing well. I like Ben Davies. I think he's been playing pretty decent as well. He had the ball a lot against United, and he played okay last night. I do quite like the Dier-Sanchez partnership. That's working quite well. Yesterday, I thought Aurier wasn't too bad either, even though he didn't have much coming his way. Had he been smarter in the final third, I think we probably would have destroyed West Ham, because he did have some really good opportunities to lay it on the plate for one of our forwards. And I think Hugo's been very good as well. It has been a much better defensive performance, but again, especially against a Manchester United team that was packed full of talent. Last night, Antonio does like to give Spurs the runaround, but he was pretty much marginalised apart from one long ball over the top. And if this is this a Mourinho effect, I don't know. I would like to think so, and I hope so.
So the outstanding player in the match last night against West Ham was Lo Celso. Really, really good to have him back. He played in the double pivot with Sissoko, which I suppose was somewhat of a surprise. We've primarily seen Sissoko play in the band in front or as part of three, or at least a diamond. So did putting him in as a two feel like a risk to you, Nathan?
A mild risk, but I also think it would be risky to not play him in that role, because he's going to be our best mover of the ball from that area of the pitch, at least at the moment. I think potentially Ndombele can be better, but he's obviously not in that situation at the moment. So yeah, when we talk about risk, like, yeah, of course, if you, not that he's like even vaguely defensively poor, like he's very proactive, he gets good defensive numbers, and maybe he can let a runner slip behind him, but then so could, like, you know, maybe the more recognized defensive option in Winks too, although it was good against United, so maybe that's harsh to be saying right now. So yeah, I think a necessary risk, and therefore not really a risk.
Harry James says, what do you think Lo Celso's best position will be long term? Buddy, do you have a favourite Lo Celso?
I said to you guys last night, my favourite Lo Celso is the one that sits deep. I've seen him play wide a few times for Argentina. Obviously, he was quite effective with Betis playing further forward. But I think for us, in that deeper role, playing a version of Moussa Dembele, we saw that in some games in the FA Cup against Southampton away, and we saw that last night. He was able to influence the game from that deep position. Most touches, most opposition half passes, most successful passes. You know, he won possession back 13 times. I really like him in this deep role. I think that's where his future is for us. I really like him there.
I think it's also worth saying that people look at Lo Celso and say, well, there's no goals, no assists. I think that's the wrong framework to be judging him against. I think you need to look at Lo Celso as more of a Modric than an Eriksen, for example. And he's more likely to get the hockey assist, or more likely to break the opposition offence and then switch it quickly, transition, allow us to transition and move the ball vertically. I mean, I can't help but think if we'd signed Lo Celso at the point where Dembele was declining, it just makes me sad to think that, actually. It's probably best I don't think that.
Yeah, I think Lo Celso alongside I mean, Sissoko did fine. He did okay. He made some decent interceptions. He covered a lot of ground. But there's always that moment when he gets the ball and it's just like, now move it quickly, or change the direction of the play, or lay it into Lo Celso, then move into a different angle for him. I think perhaps with Winks alongside, I think we did see a bit of Lo Celso and Winks before lockdown. Maybe with Winks, but obviously a better defensive midfielder alongside him. I think there's a glorious partnership there.
So talking about midfield combinations, we had an email from Joe Gilby. He said, I have a question about our midfield. To me, it looks like our midfield is crying out for three players, a Christian Eriksen type, a Luka Modric type, and a Victor Wanyama type. At the moment, we're trying to shoehorn Sissoko into the Wanyama role, trying to shoehorn Dele and Lamela into the Eriksen role, and trying to make the Celso or Winks into the Modric role, and trying to pretend our incredible record signing Tongi is happy as Larry warming the bench. It looks like we have a lot of really fantastic midfielders who really don't fit together in any playable system. Would an out-and-out holding midfielder solve all these problems by freeing up the Celso and Tongi in a midfield three? Where does this leave Dele? Does this mean Winks never fits the system? And he says he's having sleepless nights thinking about this and feels utterly lost. Help. Nathan, what do you think? Is there any way we can make our current midfield options work? I know you're going to say we primarily need to sign a defensive midfielder, but even with a defensive midfielder, what do we do?
Primarily, we need to sign a defensive midfielder. I think that things like the Sissoko and the Lo Celso midfield two can sort of work middlingly well. I think we're still going to struggle because you don't want Lo Celso to be deep to Sissoko too often, and then it's a trouble to get the ball into a position where it's ahead of Sissoko and where Lo Celso is getting on the ball. But I think functionally, I've been really impressed through two games with Moussa Sissoko's defensive midfield work as the deepest midfielder. Not so much like sitting, not dropping between centre backs, all that kind of stuff, but you know, as a sort of a, I guess you'd say a defensive number eight, just keeping it tidy, moving the ball on first. And I think that, yeah, as a result, his best partner is Lo Celso, because Lo Celso is the best ball mover in the squad. And like we talked about specifically with the West Ham game, but also generally, you take any kind of risk with Lo Celso's sort of adventurousness because you need someone who can progress the ball through midfield in that way. So I think that's our best midfield for now. Long term, yeah, get a good rounded defensive midfielder, either one that pushes forward or sits back, and you can decide how you want to shape the midfield based on that. And then, yeah, you can partner him with Ndombele maybe, if that's going to work out, or if not, Lo Celso, you can play them as a three, definitely, or you can move Lo Celso forward. I think, to go back to the previous question, Lo Celso's best position is wherever he is going to be most needed by us, wherever, depending on out of the makeup of our squads and who's fit and who we're playing against, etc., etc., etc. You know, he's got a brilliant skill set that works both in multiple positions. positions and in multiple roles. He can thrive depending on what's needed, definitely. And it depends. I think for now, the Sissoko, Lo Celso midfield makes sense. And Winks in there, you know, either role certainly can fill in, but remains to be seen sort of long term, depending on who we may or may not sign.
Okay. So one of the reasons that I felt a bit down about Mourinho's Tottenham last night was I couldn't get my head around his use of the squad, and in particular his use of the subs, or lack of use for subs. So across these two games, I mean, there was kind of meme-like banter that Mourinho would use all five subs really early and do all these crazy things. So he's used 5 out of his possible 10 subs so far. Some people are taking that as a positive, saying, you know, it's really good that we need to kind of get the running into the legs of our players who are fresh back from injury. My stance is that's a huge gamble to take, that we're kind of putting them at risk of suffering muscular injuries by not giving them sufficient rest. We're also not giving fitness opportunities to other fringe players who we might need for some of the remaining games. And there's the obvious point that we're missing out on potential sort of tactical opportunity as well. Bardi, were you surprised by how few subs Mourinho used in the first two games?
Mourinho's been a manager throughout his career. He's always gone through seasons with using a limited amount of players. I think at the moment he has a core set of players that he trusts, and those are the players that we're seeing at the moment. I'm not sure if he's sending a message to the players who aren't playing. I don't know if he's sending a message to the chairman and everybody else, but he seems to have the players that he wants to play, and he plays them, and he's not giving away 3 minutes for the sake of people getting on the pitch just to have a run around. He's making his substitutions according to what he thinks needs to happen in the match. And yeah, he's not giving 3 minutes to anybody that he thinks doesn't deserve it. I'm not saying that's a correct way, but I'm just saying that's what I think he's doing.
The obvious loser in this is Ndombele, who we were all hoping to see a lot more of. How do you feel about this, Nathan? I mean, from an Ndombele perspective, but also from a kind of Tottenham perspective.
It's frustrating. I defended the limited substitution use after the Man United game because we are in that equal game state because of, you know, various fitnesses and everything. But I was definitely frustrated with the West Ham game because I think that was a perfect opportunity to, at the very least, you know, get 5 minutes of game time into Ndombele's legs to, you know, demonstrate to everybody publicly that he was still in his plans, that all of the drama that went down during the lockdown was for something and about something. So I was really frustrated because there were unused subs, there was opportunity to bring him on, there was a good circumstance to bring him on, there were players to take off for him. So I'm really frustrated. And then obviously a bunch of French sourced rumours came out suspiciously directly after the game, of course. But it's really annoying.
So the interesting thing about those rumours was that Alistair Gold predicted that this would happen. He said that if Ndombele doesn't get game time, you might notice that, you know, the people around him will leak some information to the French press. That did happen. Mourinho obviously denied it straight away. Alistair was very brave and kind of fronted Mourinho up on the subject in the press conference post-match. It's really difficult to work out with Mourinho when he is being totally genuine or not. He said something along the lines of he sometimes wants to thank the players or apologise to the players who he didn't give an opportunity to, who've been working hard in training. And I couldn't tell without hearing him say those words and the tone of voice whether he meant that genuinely, like he was, you know, sorry to Ndombele in particular that he couldn't give him minutes, or whether there was a kind of slight hint of sarcasm there, because what we do know is that Ndombele didn't warm up during the game. He was the only substitute that didn't get off the bench and go through the motions of the warm-up. That might be because he wasn't asked to. Who knows? But it certainly seems odd. Bardi, how are you feeling about the Ndombele situation more generally?
Well, Alistair wrote an article and he talks about, he obviously was at the pitch, and I don't think he's biased one way or the next, but he did say that Ndombele looked like he wasn't interested. And if you compare him to Vertonghen, Alderweireld and Jedson as well, that he just seemed to be lacking the effort to put in the training. And perhaps, I don't know, I don't want to judge, I don't want to judge the individual because I don't know him. But at this point in time, the only person we can trust in is Mourinho. And if Mourinho chooses not to play him, then it's Mourinho's decision. It's a complicated case. I don't know. Obviously, the bits I've seen of Ndombele, he looks amazing. And last night, he could have really changed the game for us, getting on the ball. And you know, when you see Lucas getting the ball deep, and you're like, God, if that had been Ndombele, perhaps something could have happened there. But I don't know. Right now, the only thing I can do is side of Mourinho and say there's a reason why he's not picking him. And Mourinho knows best whether or not that's right or not. Only time will tell.
Yeah, I've flip-flopped on this. I thought that Ndombele's time was done after Mourinho's post-match rant about him. And then during lockdown, where Mourinho seemed to be sort of taking extra care to put him through his paces, I thought, well, maybe this is a good sign. Maybe you know, he's really trying to take him on as a project and make a go of this. Then it's come out since that Mourinho said he was fixing Ndombele's training gear, basically, that he was making the training setup work, not actually, you know, giving him personal training sessions as such. And then this handling of him where he's not even had a single minute, it just seems odd. I if it's his kind of authoritative form of man management, I don't like it, frankly. I think it's a mistake. I think he's going to burn bridges, and I think one of the most talented midfielders in Europe could end up leaving us as a result of it. What do you think, Nathan?
Yeah, no, that's my worry. Well, I don't want to suggest that Ndombele is completely faultless. That he's, you know.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's really important that this is a balanced conversation.
I mean, obviously, we don't know the details. We can only go by like what we can sort of mind read on in the stadium and what the rumours are and everything. I find it completely feasible, and he does have some sort of history in this area as a teenager, really. So I find it completely believable that Ndombele has put feet wrong. You know, we saw his performance against Burnley, of course. You know, I'm sure there's definitely more he could be doing, but look at Mourinho, and the reason I made that Pogba tweet is like, look at Mourinho's history with Pogba, with De Bruyne, with Salah, with Mkhitaryan, with even go back like Joe Cole,
Luke Shaw,
yeah, you know, again and again and again and again, club after club, and like
often young players,
often talented players, and I'm not saying that like none of those players share any faults. What I'm saying is that Mourinho allows players to fail him quite happily, quite readily, and then moves on to another club. And I think that, okay, sure, yes, absolutely, Mourinho has won a lot of trophies. He's had a lot of wins in games, a lot of success. I think that that's fading. Has not faded. It's not impossible that he can come back and improve in those areas. But I think that he does a lot of damage to the other assets, that he prioritises himself, of course, which manager wouldn't, but to the extent where, you know, by the time he's left your club, you might have had some success, but it's done you in, because you've, you know, broken your transfer records to bring in a player that Mourinho will then scapegoat for his underperformance in training.
If we take this at face value, if we assume that Mourinho is just picking the fittest players, the most appropriate players for the system he wants to play, let's think of it in this context. Gareth Thomas says, for those who want Ndombele in the team, who should be dropped to make way? Would it be Dele or Lo Celso? Bardi, what do you think? If everything is fine and Mourinho is simply picking the best 11 players for his system, where does Ndombele come in?
I mean, he doesn't replace Lo Celso. At the moment, he probably replaces Dele. You play Sissoko in the defence midfield role, Lo Celso and Ndombele the other side, and then you play your front three of Son, Bergwijn and Kane, and that's how you move forward from there. Where that leaves Dele long term, I don't know. That's the big question mark at the moment. Where does Dele fit in? I don't think Dele works in a number 10 role. He's not influential enough for me for a long enough period of time over a match. So I think Dele eventually would be probably the one that loses out if Mourinho's given the time to build to build that midfield. Ndombele should be playing alongside it, but it's not working for one reason or another. And for me, sometimes it's like, I mean, we've seen this with Mourinho. If he doesn't get on with De Bruyne, he bins him off. And I don't think he thought De Bruyne was a bad player. I just think at that time he didn't need De Bruyne, and the continued questioning and the press speculation, fan speculation, was just too much of a distraction for him and the club and everything else. So he just lets them go. I think regarding Salah, he says the club signed him. I signed him, but the club sold him. And there's also the Cuadrado's another player as well, which he signed. But I think during that time at Chelsea, yeah, Mata. But then at Man United, they seem to get on okay. I think using Chelsea as an example is pretty bad, because they just collect, especially then, they collected footballers, and then, you know, they made money off these guys at some point. So it was a business for them. I don't know. I don't know where it fits, but I think a lot of it will be down to Ndombele. Mourinho won't change. He knows that. If you read some of the beefs he's had with Drogba and people like that, that it's the player either changes or they're done. Mourinho is not going anywhere unless Tottenham fire him. So Ndombele has to change. And if he doesn't change, then he will be sold, unless before that happens, Mourinho is sacked.
I mean, when you say that Ndombele would be coming in for Dele, you can make an argument that Mourinho is simply picking the players he thinks are most effective. And he loves Dele, we know that. But also Lamela's playing really well, and he is a viable alternative to Dele also. So if it's a case of Dele or Lamela or Ndombele, you can justify the selection.
Totally.
I think it's when you... And so when you look at it in isolation like that, you can justify it. You can sort of almost picture a world in which things get better. But it's the wider context, isn't it? It's what's gone before. It's Mourinho's handling of Ndombele before, and his historical handling of similar players that gives cause for concern.
But I have a question for you, Windy. Last night, during the substitutions, who do you take off for Ndombele? Who do you replace? Because Lamela came on for Dele, and Lamela had an impact, and he was good in the ball, had a couple of chances, and was highly influential in the second goal. So do you take a risk with Ndombele instead of Lamela? Or then do you pull off Sissoko, who was playing fine, or Lo Celso, who had man of the match performance? That's where Ndombele is right now. That I think fitness, forget about fitness wise or anything else, he's just far down the pecking order in terms of form and in terms of system that Mourinho is playing.
So what I would have done is ensured that none of the players who are coming back from absences played 90 minutes in either of the games. And Sissoko's played 180, Kane's played 180, Son's played... Has Son played the whole lot? Did he come off last night?
He came off.
There's been a lot of minutes for players who are just back. So I probably would have brought on... I mean, the other thing is that the own goal, which was slightly fortuitous to get, did change things for Mourinho, because it opened the game up to an extent, and it meant that he didn't need to necessarily bring on Ndombele for Sissoko, for example. He didn't need to be more adventurous with his selection. So that kind of goes in his favour as well. But yeah, I mean, I would have found a way to get Kane off the pitch earlier and rest him and bring someone else on, whether that be Sessegnon, Ndombele or whoever. Having said that, you know, leaving Kane on the pitch led to him scoring a goal. And boy, wasn't that nice. Nathan, you tweeted some klaxons about Harry Kane last night.
Yeah.
Why was that?
Well, we talked about in the previous episode about the extent to which he was a passenger against United, and he very much was, except for, you know, like 5 minutes where he was drifting out to the left and he had a couple of nice passes, but other than that, he was basically not involved in the game. And we talked about the wider context of this, which is that Harry Kane is one of the best strikers in the world, but for the last 2 years, he's underperformed, seemingly, likely, quite possibly because of a fitness issue stemming from a series of injuries, mainly ankle injuries, and playing a hell of a lot of football and coming back from injury too soon and again and again and again. He's finally had a lengthy break after an injury because there was simply no football to being played. He's come back looking a little rotund on the waist, which I'm literally glad to see, because it means that he has been resting. It means that he has been fueling, and it means that he has been healing. And very quickly, we've gone from, oh God, he's a passenger, try not to think about it against United, to he's had a shot in the box. He's had a shot in the box with his foot. He's burst through in behind the defence, kept the ball for multiple touches, kept ahead of the defenders and converted the shot. And then, right at the death, when he probably shouldn't have been on the pitch because Ndombele could have been subbed on for him, he jumps towards a far post cross, left foot four, nearly gets to it. It's a sprint and a leap. And there are examples of explosivity into his game again, which for me is really exciting. It's too soon, like it was too soon last week to say Harry Kane is dead. He'll never be a professional level footballer again. It's too soon to say Harry Kane is back. We have the best striker in the world again. Hooray! But it's a big, exciting step in that direction for me, and I'm more positive about Harry Kane than I am about anything else to do with Spurs for sure.
And the good news is he didn't pick up any muscle injuries.
That we're aware of so far.
And he's now got a little break. So that's kind of come at the perfect time in terms of his recovery. So let's hope that he continues on that kind of upward trajectory, because it was so good to see him looking shot hungry. And, you know, he had a couple of early thwacks at goal, which were from range, but he managed to keep on target. And he seemed to grow in confidence from that point. So really good. He also hit a bit of a milestone, Bardi.
Yeah, he's only Aguero scored more goals than him after 200 Premier League matches, which is, that's some going for Kane, who's not been playing for a free-flowing Man City team who just kind of thump everybody. He's also now the joint second. He's third on the list of most London derby goals, which is a weird stat for them to throw out, but it's still a nice stat anyway. I was happy with Kane. He was pretty bad the first 20-25 minutes, but I think that was maybe down in a large part to how we were playing. And Nathan's right, he did have a couple of proper bursts of speed, which is good to see. His legs held together. You know, sometimes when you see a Formula One car and it gets a puncture as it's accelerating and just bits of tyre fling out all over the place. His hamstrings didn't do that, which is great. So I'm happy. And, he surprised me in his post-match comments. He was like, I'm 26 years old. And you go, bloody hell. You know, we think, I don't know how you perceive Kane, but I perceive Kane as like this man, this figurehead, this leader. He's 26 years old, you know, and it's incredible the kind of presence and influence he has. And he's still a boy. So he's still got, I've now turned, he's got a lot of goals in him. So let's keep him forever.
I love him so much. Alec Dipkrinsky, hope I pronounced that right. He says, is the Aurier role, i.e. Serge pushed up high on the right flank, deployed nominally as a right back but playing more as an out winger, a result of Mourinho's squad limitations, or do you see it as a planned tactic that Jose would stick with even with different, possibly better personnel available? What do you think, Nathan? And he also adds, if it is here to stay, name a realistic target that you'd like to see replace Aurier in that role.
Kieran Trippier. Is it a matter of squad limitations or is it a planned tactic? Yes to both. Like, it makes a lot of sense for the current shape of our squad. It doesn't make sense for Sessegnon, but it makes sense for the rest of our squad. And also, it's, you know, a smart way to set up generally. So even with different squad circumstances, it would be, you know, a smart approach regardless. So it could well be here to stay. Right backs. So I like Jaden Bogle. Where's my list of right backs?
I like that you have a list, just a list of possible transfer targets just hanging around on my desk. Where's that piece of paper?
I literally do, but I don't have it to hand. Hang on, someone fill the air for a minute while I look up some names.
I think this Aurier role it proves quite effective. It gives us the ability to switch the ball. It gives us a player running in behind Son and Lucas or Bergwijn. They tend to get the ball and cut inside. It gives us a bit of penetration down the side. And had he just been a bit smarter with his final touch and his final ball, then, as I said earlier in the pod, I think we would have marmalised West Ham. It's something we saw him do it into with Maicon. He switched on it. He said left. He had Maicon bombarding down the right. So it's a very Mourinho thing, but I think it works. And perhaps if we just improve the person we use as the point of the arrow, then we could maybe get some joy from it.
It's really interesting because Aurier's actually got a decent number of assists this season. Most of them, from my reckoning, have come from slightly deeper crosses. And I think when he's higher up the pitch, he actually lacks the kind of composure to take a touch and consider his options. He's much better when he just whips it in from an early... He's a really good crosser from deep, actually. Similarly to Trippier, I would say.
I think Trippier was better at the volleyed crosses, where it would half-volley cross.
So good at those.
Yeah, he was pretty good at those. I mean, it's always weird. Aurier is fine in the kind of middle, in like the part of the pitch between the halfway line. But then you put him at the other either end, and it's a little bit haywire.
Yeah.
He still does do his one man pressing machine on his own, where he just charges out of position, and he could easily get exposed if the other team were a bit smarter.
Yeah, no, I agree. I still think Aurier is a pretty bad footballer, to be honest, and definitely not the kind of right back that you want if you've got top four aspirations, but title aspirations. I mean, we need to... That's a fairly easy upgrade, I would say, right back. I mean, I'd say the same about left back, to be honest. And obviously, defensive field stands out as another easy upgrade. Nathan, do you have your list?
I like Emerson. I like Ona Aina. Who else have we got? Matty Cash and Bogle, I mentioned.
Funny you mentioned Cash. We had an email about Cash. He's playing there for the first... He's playing right back for the first time, as I understand it, this season. He's previously been, I want to say, a midfielder. Yeah. Who was it? Austin Stanovic emailed us about Matty Cash. He said this has been his first year at right back, so it could be a risk, but he's looked great all season.
Yes.
So you agree with Austin?
Yeah, no, I... it is, yes. He's played like a mixture of different roles. I think this season he's sort of more been sort of fixed into the right back role. But he looks good. He's doing good. Obviously, he wants to continue to develop on his defensive game. But if we're looking at like Aurea role players, then like Cash and Vogel, championship fullbacks who are like outstanding attacking, could do with some defensive work, are the ones to be looking at.
I really like Vogel. I like Nathan Ferguson, who's out of contract, but he's not played that many games. So I feel like he'd be a kind of buy and loan back. The other thing to say is, it is insane how many good young English right backs there are in the Premier League at the moment. And I'm thinking Trent Alexander-Arnold. I'm thinking Reece James, who I think is exceptional.
Aarons.
I'm thinking Max Aarons. I'm not so keen on Aarons. James Justin at Leicester is really good.
Okay.
And Tarik Lamptey, who's joined Brighton from Chelsea, is a brilliant ball carrier from right back. These are all fantastic young English right backs. We've got a plethora of talent, and I assume that one of them will end up playing left back for the national team, because you can't get them all on the pitch at once.
It's interesting. Scotland have two of the best left backs in the world and no right backs, and we've got a plethora of right backs and no left backs. That's interesting. Bring on the great British national team. What was I going to say? I forgot. I was desperate to say something and I forgot what it was. Carry on.
Was it Max Aarons?
No. I mean, he's on the short side. So I understand sort of any reservations with that talented player.
I mean, if you're going to sign Max Aarons, just use Walker Peters. Okay, Drog914 from Reddit says, how much of our early struggles under Jose can be attributed to our lack of fluidity on counters? It seems to me this is a huge component of his tactics. I thought there were actually some bright moments yesterday. He means the United game. Although generally, pre-COVID, we were often abysmal, granted we were missing players. And he also says, what is our best midfield forward grouping to take advantage of this? So it's around the fluidity of counterattacks. And I agree that I thought there were some decent counterattacks against United, often started by Lamella. I thought there were also some decent attacks against West Ham, though we didn't really play on the counter so much because they just gave up possession, essentially. But what do you think, Bardi, about our fluidity, and who do you think are our best midfield and forward options?
And it's very difficult to be fluid when your midfield is so bitty, and then it's even more difficult to be fluid when your best counter-attacking threat, Son and then Kane, are injured. I mean, when Mourinho started, we saw an upturn in form, which is probably a new manager bounce. But then as players got injured and perhaps the new manager bounce wore off, that's where our problem started. I'm not too concerned about it. I think this year, the way we're playing and the way we're set up is, I personally, I wanted us to play with a plan for next season, but I think Mourinho's still very much chasing top four, top five. So he's literally just doing whatever he can to get that, but by doing as little tweak and as little gambling as possible, sticking to our strengths and going very much the blood and thunder tactic that Pochettino used to great effect in his last 7-8 months at Tottenham, well, his last year, really, of just trying to get the biggest guns on the pitch at once and blow teams away. So I'm not too worried about fluidity at the moment. Yeah, that's me. I'm not too worried about it.
Nathan, how do you feel about our counter-attacking prowess?
This is really interesting. This is something I've been thinking about quite a lot recently. So like your set possession attacks, that's something that you drill and train and you use meta ideas and micro ideas and you use drill after drill after drill. And you have various roles and you
roll. Juego de posición.
Yes. Positional play and all of that kind of good, interesting stuff. Whereas counterattacks, not that you'd never coach them, like there's never any involvement from the manager at all, but much more is the case where you just let your players improvise. You let them get on with it. You give them the tools and the circumstances, which is space to attack into, and you let them come up with something new every time because they're harder to read. And because very good players will just consistently make chances out of counterattacks. The creation aspect of a counterattack is turning the ball over in the first place. This is really interesting. So again, there is still some, you know, you do some counterattack drills. You say, "Son, I still want you to say wide if you don't have the ball until this point, etc." But why have our counterattacks not been very good? Maybe our counterattackers haven't been very good. Maybe it's a matter of Kane's fitness, which we've just been discussing. But I also wonder if it's just that counterattacks aren't that good anymore. If most teams can counter press to at least a reasonable level, you're taking off 10, 15, 20% of the effectiveness of attacking into space like that. I don't know. I don't have an answer for this at all. I think it's really interesting because, yeah, we were pretty wasteful with our counters against United, and that's been the case, you know, at least a moderate amount. I think that we've seen towards the end of games, West Ham being the example most recently, but again earlier in the season as well, at the end of games when we're in the lead and teams are really exerting ourselves, we've been much more effective on the counter. But when we're an equal game state or when we're one goal above with 30 minutes plus to play, our counterattacks have been pretty poor, or maybe not even poor, but just not fruitful. And I think that's definitely one to keep an eye on, or maybe even something for me to do a bit of a deep dive on.
I think a lot of it is also down to the lack of no longer Eriksen. We don't have Eriksen to help us on the counterattacks. I think against United, some of the counterattacks kind of fell away because Lamella is fine, but he's very unable to switch the play. Like for him to open up the other side of the pitch, it takes an age, and it often results in him just running in a straight line across the pitch.
He does like to do that.
Yeah, so I think not having Eriksen there has weakened our counter-attacking. And when you watch Eriksen now after a few months in Italy, the way he plays with Lukaku and Martinez it's really nice. And I think Eriksen not being there has affected our counter-attacks more than anything else.
I think it's also a matter of perspective. I don't think we're especially good or especially bad at counter-attacks, but I think there was a period 2 or 3 years ago where we were exceptional, and therefore we seem a lot worse comparably. I totally agree with Bardi's point. I was going to make the same point myself. One of the key aspects of counter-attacking, and this doesn't even necessarily mean kind of the Poch style counter-attack where you win the ball high and play vertical passes, one of the most important parts of counter-attacking is having a player that can start off a counter effectively. He can spot the pass before the pass, or even just play the killer pass. And Nathan, you did a really nice bit of work on Twitter probably a year or so ago now, maybe 6 months, something like that, about how Eriksen just keeps things simple, how he has just really good first and second touches. He gets the ball under control quickly, and that creates space for him to do more with it. And that will allow Eriksen to, in one or two touches, get the ball and release it and start something happening. We don't have that anymore, really. Dele wants touches, or certainly the Dele at the moment wants touches to the nth degree. He takes way too many touches. Lucas gets his head down and runs with it. He doesn't look for a pass. Son is kind of the same. Like, Son, you want at the end of a counter-attack, not early in the build-up play.
Yeah.
And Kane is, you know, we know what Kane's been for the last couple of years. So we're kind of lacking the players with the ability to counter-attack. I would say the players most suited to counter-attacking well in our team are probably, I would say, Lamella and probably Ndombele, who's got like a really incisive forward pass and majestic vision. I think Lo Celso can do it, but we're talking about him potentially being a bit more of a scrapper in midfield potentially. So maybe he's the one winning the ball and then it's going to Ndombele. But it's partly personnel and it's partly perspective. We've got players who can do it, but we just, we haven't clicked into that gear yet. Having said that, if Kane can get back into the type of physicality where he's able to score more goals like he did against West Ham, that second goal, there's no reason why he can't be finishing off counter-attack goals and why we shouldn't be looking for early through balls to him, because that was a sign that he can still do that, which is very encouraging.
I think that this is one of the payoffs of Lo Celso being deeper, is that, yeah, he helps our build-up plays dramatically, but then he's not involved in those games. And that sort of Ericsson-type pass you're talking about, that's a really good point. I think counter-attacks are like, they're really exciting, right? Oh my god, my team have the ball, there's space attacking behind, your vision gets blurry, you look for that.
The opposition aren't set.
They aren't set. People are out of position and you go, oh my god, I can run into the space, or I can play the ball into the space, and you see the goal and you get tunnel vision and all of that kind of stuff, and you want to play that big killer pass, definitely. And as you say, Eriksen was so good at playing the short pass in that situation where no one else is thinking of a short pass at all, but suddenly you play 5 yards across and you find a player who has space to pick out that big pass, and that kind of thing. And yeah, I think Lo Celso can be that player who can have that sort of awareness and patience and calmness in those moments. But yeah, then maybe that's the downside of playing him in a deeper role in a counter-attack setup. But yeah, no, that's a good point with having a playmaker for the counter-attack.
The one thing that restricts Lo Celso compared to Eriksen is his one-footedness. I mean, Eriksen could do it off both feet. That was a huge advantage. Lo Celso is very, very left-footed as it stands. I mean, that could change. Anything else you'd like to say on that? No. So we'll move on to the next one from Miles V. Taylor. On the assumption, this is something we get asked over and over, actually. I think it's something people are really interested in. On the assumption that our chance of getting Champions League is over, what would you rather? Europa League for some European football next year, or no European games at all so we can have a clear run of a league? There are clear arguments for both, obviously. And there's nothing to say that not having Europe kind of gives you a better shot at winning the league. But I think something that's oft overlooked is that it's not just about the fitness issues of playing 2 games in a week. It's about the planning of training. So if you're playing 1 match every week, roughly, you are constantly focused on your next opposition for those probably 5 days that you're training, and you don't have to worry about a day of travel and match and then a day of recovery. So you've got more time on the training pitch to prepare for one opposition team, which has got to be a huge, huge advantage. We've gone over this before, but just briefly, Bardi, would you like Europa League football or not?
Well, to win the Premier League now, you've got to do 97 points. I don't think Tottenham has ever going to get to the point where we can do those kind of numbers.
Sweet, right, pack it so in. We're done. Nice one.
Yeah. Well, I think if we look at what Manchester City and Liverpool did last season, what Liverpool done this season, I think, can I see Spurs putting up those kind of numbers? I don't know. I don't think so. So I prefer us to keep the Europa. If we don't have Champions League, then Europa League for me is something that I would like us to be in. It offers us a chance to win silverware. It offers us a chance to get back into the Champions League. So, and it's more football matches. More football matches is always better. You can always forget about the bad things that have happened when Spurs win a game. So I want Spurs to play as many matches as possible.
Yeah, so from like an entertainment perspective.
Yeah, just you can forget about the misery of your life by watching Spurs, because their misery is always great. you can forget about everything else.
And Nathan, just briefly from you, do you have a preference?
Don't like Europa League. Think that it does more damage to your league form than it gives you in the potential to win in return. I think that 2 games a week is too many games from a player perspective, from a training perspective, maybe even from an entertainment perspective. The opposing argument, the major opposing argument has always been, but we need that Europa League money, right? We earn a lot. Whereas, you know, Chelsea can benefit from not being in Europa League. Whereas even Liverpool can benefit from not being in Europa League. Whereas United have benefited when they're not in Europa League. They can afford to not play in it, whereas we maybe can't. And that is going to be even more true now than it has been before. So maybe given the circumstances, I don't know the details of what the pandemic has and hasn't done in terms of of our financials, but maybe we're really dependent on it. And I think it looks like as low as 8th place is going to get Europa League. So hopefully we're good enough to finish 8th.
I mean, but there are the positives to look at it. If you, Arsenal, who are awful at the moment, their best players are the young players who've benefited from Europa League time. Manchester United's best, one of Manchester United's best players, Rashford, benefited from Europa League time. We've seen it with Harry Kane, that these players get minutes. We know Mourinho doesn't like to tinker too much, but Europa League will give young players and squad players those minutes to play football. And I think we could all agree that youth players getting minutes is an important thing.
Speaking of that, Droney Mitchell on Reddit, brilliant username by the way, says, do you think we'll ever see Jack Clarke play in a Spurs shirt?
Nope.
Who?
It does feel that way, doesn't it? So Mauricio Pochettino oversaw the signing of Jack Clarke and then immediately loaned him out
to a club to
his mate Bielsa at Leeds. The problem with that loan move is that when Jack Clarke is no longer Leeds' player, the inclination to actually use him it just isn't there as it once was. Mm. So he quickly got recalled. It wasn't working out, and he ended up going to QPR, where again he's barely played. What they should have done in hindsight is send him to a League One club and got him 20 odd games of League One football, which would have stood him in really good stead for either a Championship or lower Prem loan. But as ever, Spurs mess up the loan, and it's not looking great for Clark. What I would say is, when I've seen Clark play at his own age group level for England, so you're talking the best 15 players in the country at that age group, he is exceptional. He stands out. He absolutely stands out. He's a very, very, very talented player. He's also quite an unusual player in that he's quite a good size. He's quite tall, but he plays out wide. That's a bit of a throwback in some ways, but I can see that being really handy from a kind of getting in at the back post and scoring goals from a wide position perspective. So I am still excited about Clark. I just think it's absolutely crucial that we get the next stage of his development right, because as we've seen with many Spurs youth prospects over the last, over Pochettino's tenure, we've got a lot of the development wrong. So it's vital that the next decision for Clark is the right one.
I mean, yeah, he's still only 19 and he's obviously a very talented player. It just feels like he's a million miles away from the squad now, and which is a hard way to feel about a player who literally cost us millions of pounds to purchase recently.
And in many ways, the same can be said of Sessegnon.
Yeah, I mean, I thought he was, I mean, he was and he is a place to play Premier League football. He was a good Premier League player for Fulham before he joined us, and he should be, you know, getting more minutes than he is. It's complicated because he's a Premier League ready winger and he's a Premier League developing level fullback. And like, where do you want to prioritise? Is it about getting him minutes? Is it about getting him the right specific minutes where he's playing in his role? And also, how are we as a club utilising the left-back role right now? You know, he's not going to come in and play a sort of a hybrid centre-back role, is he?
No, absolutely not.
So it's I was really excited about his signing, and I've been excited about him as a player for a long time. I want to see him be our fifth sub and come on as a winger just to get minutes, just for the sake of getting minutes, to say that he has them, to, you know, maybe get the occasional goal, maybe, you know, take part in a counter-attack once the game's dead kind of thing here and there. There's an incredibly, incredibly talented attacking left back in there. And he shouldn't be as far away from the team that he is.
I agree. Okay, one more for the road. This is from Palindrome Pirate, another
good
great
name,
screen
yeah.
name. He says, should players face retrospective yellows for simulation now that we have VAR, and what can be done to mitigate inconsistent VAR decisions? The first point, I suppose, is in response to the penalty incident at Man United, where the penalty wasn't given. And I actually think it's a really interesting talking point, and I would say, yes, they should be given for simulation now that we have VAR, given that there is now an opportunity for another referee or refereeing team to look at a decision or an incident in slow motion and decide whether a player's dived. But where you draw the line there is really challenging, given that we've already shown that there are major issues with that.
Okay, right. You take up the position then that you think you should give out yellows for simulation. So I will say, what is simulation?
Mm-hmm.
That's a fair point.
It's a fair point.
Is it simulation trying to win a penalty? Is it simulation trying to get someone a second yellow card? I think if you start doing that, then you're opening up the possibility for every single challenge in a football match to be brought into question. I think if you're going to do it, I think you possibly just limit it to penalty incidents and then just ignore everything.
So Lamella was fouled in the box against West Ham and he didn't go down, yep. And he carried on because he thought he could have a shot, and he did manage to get the shot off and he shot it into the side netting from a poor angle. If he'd gone down, it would very likely have been called as a penalty because it was a foul, but the foul wasn't called because he didn't go down. If he goes down, is that simulation? Is it not simulation to stand up? Does that mean basically every penalty we've won as a club for the last 15 years was simulation, except for where someone's had their leg obliterated and maybe even then they could have possibly stood up on one leg still? Are the vast majority of fouls simulation? Because like any circumstance in which you aren't completely and absolutely knocked off your feet, if you go to ground, you are exaggerating contact. I think you're justified in exaggerating contact because of that Lamella example, right? He's fouled. He doesn't demonstrate that he's fouled. Therefore, he's not awarded the foul. In fact, it wasn't a call for a penalty. No one went to the ref. The ref paid it no attention. It wasn't a conversation, even though it was definitely a penalty because he's impeded the player. I think people think it's only a foul if you completely prevent, for example, in the Lamella example, okay, you tripped Lamella, but he still managed to get to the ball. Yes, he still managed to get to the ball, but because of the trip, perhaps, we can't tell, that's impeded his ability to take that strike. Maybe if he didn't get that very light trip, he manages to strike the ball better, and that shot that he managed to get away is instead a goal, or maybe just a slightly better shot, or maybe a shot that the keeper can touch down and then it falls back into another Spurs player's path. What is a foul? What is simulation? What are any of these terms that we use? What do any of them mean? I think my personal opinion, my personal suspicion at least, is that a lot of the conversation around what counts as diving, what counts as simulation, what counts as exaggeration comes from less of a place of fairness and justice and more about masculinity and being tough and being strong and being brave and being bold. And I don't think any of these professional athletes who play most of their careers through injury, who remain on the pitch if they're the third or maybe now fifth sub when they've obliterated their ankle, etc., are soft because they choose to go down tactically and smartly when they've been tripped in the box because it's impeded their ability to strike a ball as well as it could have done before they were tripped.
You are, of course, Nathan, absolutely correct. I mean, the issue is not around simulation, it's around the standards of refereeing and the, as you say, what is a foul. And yes, I think referees need to start calling the Lamella decision as a foul in order to change our perception and players' perceptions of what a foul is. So often we see a player impede another in a kind of non, as long as they're not doing a slide tackle, then impeding a player seems fine, doesn't it? And that's not right.
I don't know. It could be we decide that we as football come together and we say you can give a player a nudge, you can give a player a barge, you can give a player a kick or a trip, as long as you don't completely wipe them out. If that's what's stated, if that's what's written down, and that's what we agreed, or that's what is commissioned as the rules, and that's the rules. But we are trapped in this grey area where if a player on your team is lightly tripped, it's a foul. Whereas if a player on their team is lightly tripped, then they're cheating.
Yeah. It brings it back to Pogba against Dier. Pogba, done Dier, got in the box, and he was just waiting. That foul, that push doesn't take Pogba down, but he knew what he was playing. And Lamella should have done the same yesterday. In the box, feel contact, fall over, penalty.
And we see Harry Kane do it all the time, you know, encourage contact by leaving a leg out or slowing your run down and changing your stride to the extent where you're naturally going to feel contact and then you hit the deck.
And people hate him for it. People really get incredibly upset about him allowing himself to be fouled and then demonstrating that he's fouled. The rules as written would suggest that basically any kind of contact is a foul. The rules as perceived by fans and pundits is that it's only a foul if you're completely wiped out. And the rules as practiced by referees is anywhere between those extremes from one moment to another.
Yeah.
And it's kind of why VAR is not overruling decisions, because it's not unless it's a clear one where Fernandez has gone down where he hasn't even been touched and the ball's clearly been played. VAR is unwilling to change the decision. There's not enough of an error because it still exists within that grey area.
So in response to Nathan's original question, which is what is simulation, there would have to be some hard lines there, and one of them would be if there is no contact at all and a player throws himself to the ground, then that is simulation. If a player one of the scenarios that really annoys me is where a player might like flick out at another one and then they'll go down clutching their face to try and get them sent off.
Okay.
I really hate that behaviour. I think they are fairly clear cut, those ones, and you know you can give a yellow card for those. But you're right that there has to be a very clear cut off, because otherwise you create another problem just like the existing one we have with fouls in the penalty area.
Even the contact no contact one is difficult. I think that there isn't at least an argument to be made that if you as a defender step across the striker's path and they jump over your foot, then you've impeded them. You've affected their stride.
You've changed stride. Yeah.
I think if you look at the Fernandes one, like there's, you know, a reality where Dier keeps his foot in and Fernandes makes the contact as he's falling. And there's the one that we exist in which Dier pulls out and Fernandes is already falling over and the contact isn't made and he continues to fall over. I think even then, the contact element is still not like a perfect indicator, because you take some of those Kane penalties where he is committed to falling before the contact comes in, and if for whatever reason somehow the contact doesn't come in, then he's fallen over of his own accord. Physically, safety-wise, it is safer to, you know, relax into the contact. Because, you know, if you're planted and that contact comes in at high speed, you can, you know, again, especially if you're Harry Kane, do your ankle quite a bit of damage. So contact obviously gives us a lot of insight, but I don't think it gives us definitive answers either.
I really didn't think we were going to get that much conversation out of that question, but turned out it was a banger. What I'm going to do now is give a little treat to the people who have stuck around. I had a conversation with someone in midweek who knows a Premier League manager. And I don't know how true this is, but he told me some snippets. It's
absolutely,
about the
completely, 100% true, verified by the extra inch.
He told me some snippets about the Project Restart manager's call. Here's what he told me. He said that they had a call on Zoom and that Mourinho sat looking disinterested throughout most of the call. He said for 55
I've
minutes.
Been there.
And then at the end of the call, one of the managers said, "Are we all in agreement then?" And Mourinho suddenly piped up, What are we agreeing on?" It also became clear during the call, when everyone else was at home, that Jose Mourinho was in the Spurs training ground, where he'd also been at all of the previous calls. So he'd essentially been carrying on going to the training ground where everyone else was locked down. Apparently, a lot of the other managers are quite fond of Mourinho, that he's quite accessible, that he answers the phone and is willing to have a chat and give advice. Not the same for Klopp, interestingly. The other thing was that apparently Mourinho kept switching his camera off every time Arteta was talking, which is an interesting snippet. And this one I find really problematic. Apparently, Mourinho said, "I've had enough of all these players moaning about COVID," at which point the Watford manager took great offence, particularly in light of
sure.
Troy Deeney has been campaigning for. And Mourinho's response was, "Well, he's paid a lot of money." Wow. One final snippet. Arteta made a kind of salient point about player safety, and Mourinho said, "Well, I presume we're going to be having a Zoom call for the masseuses and the typists and the catering managers to ensure that they're safe to go back to work." So there you go, an insight. I don't know, take it as you will. Who knows if that's true, but that's just a bit of information that someone told me this week and said that I could say on the podcast. There we go, that is the extra inch for this week. We've got loads more questions to answer on transfers, and given that we've got a little break now between our next match, between now and the next match, we will do that in that break. So if you have more questions about potential transfer targets, feel free to email us podcast@theextrainch.co.uk, contact us on Twitter @theextrainch. We always put calls out for questions on Twitter, and we sometimes do on Reddit as well. Thank you, boys.
Nice one.
Thank you, Wendy.
You've been listening to The Extra Inch. Thanks to Nathan A. Clark for production. Thanks to Barney for being Italian. Thanks to Adam Gardner for the artwork. Thanks to David Lindner for our intro music. You can find him on Twitter @DavyShambles and his SoundCloud DLindner. Do check him out, he's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook @TheExtraInch. Email us via podcast@theextrainch.co.uk and subscribe via your usual podcast platforms. And if you do enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review. That would really help.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.